Alright, now Chair. Chair, are you able to view the present the agenda?
Yes, I can see it, my dear.
Thank you.
Recording in progress.
Am I too early or is it 10 o'clock?
We still have a minute, Chairperson.
Okay. Marcel, I don't know what time it will be load shedding where I am today. I just hope we won't get load shedding.
I hear you, Chairperson. Thanks.
Hi, good morning, members, and also to Professor Gray and the delegation from the MRC, also to our staff members. Let me open this meeting and welcome all of you to this first meeting of our fourth term. It is very important, members, that we also take cognizance of the issue that we are having load shedding. And I just hope that everybody won't be affected by load shedding. I also hope I won't be affected. But without any ado, Marcel, can we just... Okay, the agenda is in front of you, members. It's the opening and welcome, and then apologies. Then we will have the briefing by the MRC, the overview of recent findings on COVID-19 related research. Then we'll have discussions and responses. And when we will excuse the delegation led by Professor Gray, and then we will do the adoption of the committee's fourth term program. So I will just ask members if you can adopt the agenda, please, before we continue.
Dungeni Chair, adopt the agenda.
Thank you, Member Dungeni. Is there a seconder?
Maleka seconds.
Thanks, Member Maleka. I think we've got a quorum in this meeting. I see Member Maleka, Member Dungeni, Member Christians and Member Bacher. Thank you, members. Is there any apologies, Marcel?
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members and the delegation. We have received an apology from Mr. Chavaleng, who's currently in Nigeria, but I do see that he's trying to join the meeting, Chairperson. Thank you. Chairperson, are you able to hear me?
Chair, you'll tell me when I need to start.
Must disconnect the chair, disconnect.
Sorry, I had load shedding. I'm back. And another gadget. Marcel, can you hear me?
Yes, Chairperson, I was just saying that we received an apology from Mr. Nchavaleng, but I've seen that he has joined the meeting. Professor Gray has just indicated, Chair, when you're ready, she's ready to present. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Gray, sorry for the inconvenience. I just had load shedding, so I had to go on another gadget, but you can continue.
Thank you very much. We greatly appreciate you asking us to present. We know we have lots of slides, so we're going to, you have these for your records, but we're going to try and whisk through them so that we have time for discussion. I'm going to be working with my colleagues who are part of this committee who are online, who will also take over. So just about the South African Medical Research Council, who are we? So we are a science council that's affiliated to the Department of Health. And our vision is to build a healthy nation through research, innovation, and transformation. And we do this by funding and conducting science. We have values of pioneering, partnering, excellence, respect, integrity, and citizenship. I'm not going to go through this because I think we're going to run out of time. But basically, we were established in 1969, and we focus on the 10 top causes of death and disability in South Africa, and we fund in that area. We're going to talk to you about the funding we've done for COVID research and innovation, some of our key projects, the wastewater surveillance, and then the Sisonke vaccine trial that we're about to go in and boost our healthcare workers tomorrow. So just in terms of research, is that we're able to ring fence about 177 million rand from the MRC and the Department of Science and Innovation to propel research and innovation in COVID-19. From March 29, from the time we knew that we were going into a pandemic. We've also been able to leverage another 275 million rand from Treasury and other philanthropy to fund COVID vaccine research. And we received also another 83 million rand from Treasury to support the vaccine rollout in the country. We have focused on various money in terms of the Department of Science and Innovation, and that's research on immunology, as well as supporting some of the therapeutic studies, diagnostics, because we were short of diagnostics at the beginning of the pandemic and short on rapid diagnostics as well. And we've also put a lot of money into epidemiology and disease surveillance to enable us to understand the outbreaks, as well as to track the variants of concern in our country, as well as money on virology and community engagement and other research, including gender-based violence and vaccine hesitancy. So in terms of the COVID-19 funding, we've focused, as I've mentioned, on GBV, mental health and livelihoods among selected population groups. We've also looked at sexual and reproductive health and the rights of women, issues around femicide and child femicide and COVID-19 in South Africa. As I've mentioned, the community stakeholder, perceptions, beliefs, behavior, and responses to COVID-19 in South Africa, as well as the prevalence, characteristics, and immunological responses of children who've had COVID-19, and then the impacts of COVID-19 lockdown on sexual and reproductive health services, interventions, and commodities, as well as the epidemiological study on COVID-19 transmission and the natural history of COVID-19 in KwaZulu-Natal. It was very important for us right in the beginning to support diagnostics and testing, and we were able to leverage money right at the beginning of the epidemic to support local development, to supply reagents for existing gold standard COVID-19 testing, as well as to investigate rapid alternatives, which we've seen now with the rapid tests that are happening, as well as to help streamline laboratory testing, validation, and the registration of local diagnostics and serological tests in South Africa. And we work very hard with NHLS and the SAHPRA to achieve this. In terms of research in innovation in the time of COVID, I'm going to work with all my colleagues on this. But the first thing we did was to implement a point of care study. And this is a very important diagnostic study because this helps us to understand how many people in our country who didn't come forward for COVID testing are COVID positive, and also helps us to get the best tests. So when we do surveillance studies and we do rapid tests, we're able to understand, first of all, how many people have become seropositive and what are the best tests to use for this. We've also looked at, because we obviously are worried about COVID-19 in children, we have investigated a study in children aged 0 to 19 in hospitals to try and look at the side effects and the inflammatory syndromes that are associated with COVID-19. And we've been able to both enroll children and neonates and to be able to measure the impact of COVID-19 in children to inform issues around COVID vaccine and school opening and management of children in our country. In terms of studies that we've been involved in, the study that showed that the single dose at 26 vaccine worked. This was a multi-country study, and we were able to participate in this. This led to the Sasonke study when the national rollout faltered. We were able to vaccinate 500,000 healthcare workers with the single dose J&J vaccine. And we're about to go back into the field again tomorrow to boost these healthcare workers that received the Sasonke study. We've also been able to support other therapeutic studies in COVID-19, as well as looking at immunology in people who've got COVID, as well as people who've been vaccinated. And South Africa has really led a lot of the work that we've done in immunology and in COVID-19 variants of concern. And we'll go into that a little bit later if that's of interest. But in terms of, I'm going to hand over to my colleague to talk about some of the stuff, how we supported the surveillance in the country around COVID-19.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. So one of the tools that has been developed that we've supported was developed by Hyrax Biosciences, a spin-out of the University of the Western Cape. And this allows rapid analysis of sequence data by any user that needn't have bioinformatics experience to be able to type the different variants. And so far, over 14,500 genomes have been analyzed in South Africa using this tool. And in fact, it's gone beyond that and it's used by 29 countries outside of South Africa, including 11 other African countries. On the immunology side, we have supported a number of different studies. One of these is with a group at the University of Cape Town with a healthcare worker cohort. Interestingly, they have developed a number of tools for studying both T-cell and antibody responses. I think the key findings that they have found is that the T-cell, although they're differential immune responses to different vaccines and different strains, on the antibody side, the T-cell responses are largely independent of prior infection status, and I think also have a high degree of cross-reactivity across the different variants, which is also quite encouraging for vaccine development. Also on the immunology side, we have our world leaders really in this group, in this country on antibody studies, looking at neutralization responses, but also antibody binding and effector function studies. And this group has been instrumental in really linking immunology data with the different variants, not just from natural infection, but also using sera from vaccinees. So to understand which vaccines are likely to protect against which variants now and in future. Also on the diagnostic side, we have been supporting at Fitz University, a group who very, very early on established these cultures of live SARS-CoV-2, which have been used in proficiency testing for SARS-CoV-2 PCR tests. They've adapted as necessary across the epidemic. So they've now adapted these cultures to include the different variants. And they've also now developed these non-infectious controls. So it's much safer now for these controls to be used in different laboratories. And again, these have been deployed beyond South Africa to 26 other countries. On the genomics monitoring side, we have been supporting a very large network led by Professor Tulio de Oliveira, originally from University of KwaZulu-Natal, and he's now moved to Stellenbosch University. But it's a national network for genomic surveillance for SARS-CoV-2. You would have heard a lot of Tulio in the press. He's been at the forefront of identifying new variants that are emerging in South Africa, and also comparing those globally to trace the movement of these variants across the different countries. And he's working, as I say, across this network in South Africa, but also beyond into other African countries. And then finally, one of the the diagnostic projects which we've been supporting has now received SAHPRA approval and is on the market now. So what we have here is a fully locally developed one-stop RT-PCR kit developed by the CSIR and being commercialized by Cape Bio that has received SAHPRA approval and is now available and increases our self-sustainability when it comes to diagnostics for COVID. So I'll hand over now to Renee to talk about the wastewater survey.
Angie, are you there? Okay, yes, Glenda. So just in the interest of time, we've put in quite a large number of slides, but I'm just going to choose a few to highlight. The next slide, please. The MRC started the wastewater surveillance program very early on in the pandemic when Dutch scientists discovered that the remnants of the RNA from SARS-CoV-2 could be picked up or isolated from wastewater. And what's more, they could do it 1 to 2 weeks ahead of when you could usually pick it up in communities. And the additional advantages were that we could test for symptomatic as well as asymptomatic people, and that with a single sample, you could test for SARS-CoV-2 in an entire wastewater catchment area. And in some cases, that numbers up to hundreds of thousands of people. The next slide, please. So it just shows how early on we started in March 2020. By June 2020, we were doing laboratory proof of concepts, and then soon after that, field proof of concepts, and we started our early warning system in Cape Town around July 2020. Next slide. So this program is made possible because there are five teams or five units within the MRC participating in them. The Environment and Health Research Unit does the logistics, coordination, stakeholder engagement. The laboratory work is overseen by our BRIP team. Our biostatistics unit takes part, as well as our genomics center and the TB platform. Next slide, please. At the moment, these are the key elements of the program. It has grown rapidly over the past year and a half. We have a research arm. We have a sampling arm that's quite complex logistically. Laboratory analysis, capacity development is a strong focus for us, and working towards the early warning system, and then stakeholder engagement and research uptake, making sure that municipalities translate the information into actions on the ground. And here you can see the results of an exercise in which in July 2020, there was a very high concentration of SARS-CoV-2 fragments in most of the wastewater treatment plants in Cape Town. And then over time, you can see here towards the end of that wave, you can see the concentrations reduced significantly. Next slide. And this slide just shows how the correlation, we pick up elevated concentrations of SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater, and about a week or two after that, we see the cases rise. Next slide, please. And here we see the same phenomenon in small communities. This is Stellenbosch University, and you can see here an increase in the concentration of SARS-CoV-2. At that point, the university decided to close the campus, and the concentrations declined, but the cases, this is cases for the entire city, continued to increase. And next slide, please. This slide just shows the changes in the variants. We can see here the beta variant in early May 2021. And then we see in Gordon's Bay in Cape Town the emergence of the Delta variant. And a couple of weeks later, the Delta variant was dominant throughout the Cape Peninsula. Next slide. At the moment, we are monitoring over 70 wastewater treatment plants throughout the country in the Eastern Cape, Western Cape, Gauteng and Limpopo, and our team is out in Mangaung today, so we hope to be adding Mangaung to our program in the next couple of weeks, and then we're also working with partners in Northern KZN to add them as well. Next slide. And this is the process. On a Monday, our samplers go out to all these 70, soon to be 80 wastewater treatment plants to collect a sample. They have to bring it to the lab by midday, where they do an extraction process. On Tuesdays, there's PCR analyses. On Wednesday, we prepare maps, graphs, tables to send to all the stakeholders showing the trends in SARS-CoV-2 concentrations in their wastewater treatment plants. And that gives the rest of the week for the municipalities to implement any interventions that they see fit. Next slide. And this shows our results from last week. You can see here in August, the concentrations of SARS-CoV-2 RNA in urban wastewater treatment plants were quite high. And then for the last week, a couple of weeks, it's been really, really low. Next slide shows the rural areas. And you can see the same pattern there. At the moment, we're seeing very, very low concentrations in all our wastewater treatment plant sites. Next slide. And this says the same thing, that all our levels are in the low categories. Next slide. We then provide in different formats. We provide updates to all our stakeholders on Wednesdays, and we also have a dashboard. Glenda, I think we can skip the next two slides. And these are some of the stakeholders we provide information to on a weekly basis. Next slide. And here's our dashboard. It's currently under renovation, but in the next week or two, it should be up and running again. And then any member of the public can go and see what the SARS-CoV-2 concentrations are like in their wastewater treatment plants. And that gives an indication of the COVID-19 cases likely. And next slide, please. Skills transfer and capacity development are important elements of the program. So we have lots of students being trained out in the field for sampling techniques as well as in the laboratory. Glenda, we can skip the next two slides. I think we can skip this one as well. And we've invested a lot of energy and resources in developing the platform. And so beyond SARS-CoV-2, we see it, we can develop it further to also look at chronic diseases, to look at other viruses, look at pharmaceuticals being used so we can get an indication for example, the numbers of people, the proportions of people in a particular wastewater catchment area who are on drugs for cardiac diseases, for diabetes, etc. We can also look at illicit substances and at micropollutants. Next slide. The project has received a considerable amount of media coverage internationally and locally. These are just a sample of the print media, radio, TV interviews that we conducted. Next slide. Yeah, that's it. Thanks very much for your attention.
Yeah. So, Chair, we'll just quickly go on to Sasanke. I mentioned it a little bit earlier on, and I think that you are aware of this. We mentioned that we started this as when the rollout faltered. We were able to vaccinate almost 500,000 healthcare workers. We were able to evaluate the effects of this vaccine, both in the beta and the delta variant of concern. This is just the demographics of the people who reported adverse events, and most of them occurred in the first 2 days: headache, body ache, fever, pain at the injection site. These are just the people that had serious adverse events, and it just shows you the occurrence. Most of the serious adverse events were vascular and nervous system, and this just shows you a lot of the breakdown of the adverse events, which are similar to what we see at a global level. And when we look at, because we don't have a lot of background data, we wanted to see whether any of these were over and above the expected. And yeah, you can see that the only thing that was above the expected background rates was the thrombotic thrombocytopenia and the Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is in keeping with global estimates. So we're not different to anywhere else in the world, which is reassuring for us. This also just showed that people didn't die when they got the AD26 vaccine. And we monitored this by looking at mortality from the past to make sure that we weren't, and that, you know, people were scared that if you took the vaccine, you would die. And this just demonstrates that you didn't. This shows the breakthrough infections on Sasanke. And it shows you the difference between what happened in the alpha and the beta wave. You can see the reduction in infections and death after the vaccination. And this just shows you the breakdown of the deaths in the Sasanke, as well as the how we analyzed the effectiveness, just to show that this vaccine was effective. Just shows you, as compared to people who weren't vaccinated, the reduction in hospital admissions, the reduction in ICU admissions, and the reduction in death. We also show for the first time the impact of this vaccine on HIV, and show that it showed similar effectiveness in hospital admissions and ICU care, but there was a reduction in the protection against death. And this obviously also points to the need for people with HIV and who are immunosuppressed to get additional booster doses. This just shows you that the vaccine was effective both in the delta versus the beta period. This just shows you a picture of the healthcare workers waiting to be vaccinated, to show that we were able to show that this vaccine worked in South Africa, and now we're going ahead with the boosting strategy. A lot of people we have to thank. I'm just going to move on to the end. And I think we just showed you maybe just a smattering of the work that we did, but just to say that we've tried to focus on both the social side of COVID-19 as well as the biological, and as well as to invest in interventions that are both therapeutic and vaccine related. And we hope that we can take questions on our work in gender-based violence, sexual and reproductive health, and other things that concern us, particularly COVID in children. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Professor Gray, and your team. members, there you have it. Receive the presentation. I'm going to open the floor now for discussions and responses. And if there's any clarity questions, you can raise your hands and I'll take it in that order. I see Member Latuli. You can continue.
Thank you, Chairperson, and greetings to everyone. I'm very happy to see that everyone is still alive. Presentation.
Member Latuli, we lost you. Okay, we will come back to Member Latuli. Can I have Member Christians and then Member Dongeni?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you to Dr. Gray and the other presenter. Sorry, I couldn't catch the name. But I have a few questions with regard to what Dr. Gray has said with regard to the wastewater. So it was found that the virus is found in wastewater. Now, that is particularly problematic in areas such as the Northern Cape. Now, in the Northern Cape, we have areas where the sewage pumps are broken. And sewage flows down the streets. And furthermore, there is a huge dam in one of the main roads, the R31, where the sewage has now collected into a huge, almost lake. And recently, I even found children playing in this water. And they weren't fully aware that it was actually sewage water. Now, my question to you is, Doctor, what dangers does that pose for a province like the Northern Cape, where sewage is found in almost every single street and is becoming more and more of a problem? I mean, years ago, or should I say decades ago, diseases like cholera was a huge outbreak because of sewage and so on. Does COVID-19 pose the same risk to us where sewage is such a huge issue in some of our provinces? My next question is that currently the infections are very low. I think the latest infection was a number of below 300. Now, there just seems to be a little bit of, in respect of how many active cases there are. The active cases seem extremely high. Now, how are we tracking the active cases and how accurate is that, in comparison with the currently infected, with the daily infected cases? And further to that, how can we see to it that these do not increase as we again go into our winter months next year? My next question is about the tablet that we have all recently been reading about in the media. Now, according to Pfizer, that tablet is 89% effective. What is South Africa's stance on that antiviral medication? Have we had any research on that? Are we delving into what that could mean for South Africans? And if so, will that then replace the vaccine? I think that tablet is, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, Molnupiravir. And apparently it has been approved in the UK. And then my last question to the panel members is, considering and monitoring the trends abroad, countries like Australia, where the counts have risen dramatically over the past few months. Now, taking into consideration and monitoring those trends, when can South Africans expect their next wave, if any? And how will we mitigate this as South Africans? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Member Christians. We can move to Member Dongeni.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, everybody. My question, Chair, was the funding association with the COVID-19 African
Africa Rapid Fund Grant was the funding association with the COVID-19 Africa Rapid Fund Grant. Was the funding enough for the SAMRC to carry out its mandate regarding research and innovation on COVID-19? For future research and innovating on funding 19, how much is needed by the SAMRC to fully execute its mandate on research and innovation on COVID-19? The second one, has this SAMRC formed multilateral collaboration and attract new collaboration from international partners? If so, what are the learning lessons for the SAMRC gained through this strategic partnership? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Member Dongeni. Is there any other members?
Chairperson, can I ask a final question, please, Chairperson?
You can continue, Member.
Thank you. I just want to ask about the COVID-19 vaccine for children. Now, there has been a lot of media outcry because we've seen some children, you know, who have come forward and have taken the vaccine. What has the feedback been from parents, from the children who have received the vaccine? Has there been any negative effects? And then also in terms of the response from parents and actually getting permission from parents for children to get that vaccine. Are we continuing with those vaccines or has it been put on halt because it has become quiet? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Member Christians. Member Bacha, do I see you?
Yes, Chairperson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let's welcome the presentation by Dr. Gray and the team. Chairperson, I think that for me, it's only two or three questions that I wanted to raise. One is around the issue of vaccinations. I think that Member Christians have touched on it, that we are going down in terms of ages for children to be vaccinated. However, we have not even halved the mark in terms of vaccinating adults that are supposed to take on the vaccination. Now, I just want to get a sense of how are we trying to mitigate the two, or what is it? What is the plan that we have to ensure that we reach out to those that are not eager to be vaccinated? Because my thinking is that if I'm not vaccinated, how would I encourage my kids to be vaccinated? So I just want to get a sense of how we are dealing with that one. The other one, Chairperson, is around the issue of the Sisonge implementation study. The question is, what did the study show in relation to the efficacy of the vaccination on severe COVID hospitalization and deaths among healthcare workers in comparison to the unvaccinated healthcare workers and other essential workers in South Africa? And my last question, Chairperson, is around the, let me just get to it. Just a second, Chairperson. Yeah, it's on the issue of wasteful surveillance and research program. The South African Medical Research Council has a wastewater surveillance and research program, which is commendable. How does the SAMRC wastewater surveillance and research program differ from the Water Research Commission, especially around the program on the surveillance of COVID-19 in wastewater, which was launched on the 20th of May in 2020. I hope I'm clear, Chairperson. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Member Bacha. If there's no other member, Professor Gray, allow me to pose a few questions. Let me first of all welcome this presentation by the Medical Research Council. Sorry, I've got a few questions. The first questions will go on the funding, research, and innovation. And I think some of the members have already covered me, but I'm very interested in the infections in children 5 years and above. And I want to really find out what is the situation regarding children in South Africa with the COVID-19. And then can the SAMRC briefly explain to the committee what does the solidarity trial and crown coronation study entail, and wastewater and surveillance. Excuse me. Has the wastewater surveillance and research program been effective? Is the SAMRC working with the Water Research Commission? If not, are there any prospects of collaboration in the near future? What are the difficulties in conducting sewage research for virus spread monitoring? How can COVID-19 be transmitted through sewage, wastewater, and other similar environments? And I want to lash on that question from Member Christians. Member Christians made an example of the Northern Cape, and I want to say it's not only in the Northern Cape, Professor Gray. I think it's all over, especially that is in the previously disadvantaged, very, very poor areas that we are experiencing this. And I think it is also to do with the social, the social impact of where we are in South Africa. And that's why that question is very important to me, because it is the most vulnerable people that are facing the sewage leakages every day. So that is that question has to do with is our people safe if the sewage and wastewater is running around in our townships and in the streets, and especially children and old people are very much affected by that. So that's why I pose this question, so that we can know how we must improve in our infrastructure in this country to really make sure that our communities are safe. And then also, what is the survival time of coronaviruses in water and wastewater? What have been the notable gains of undertaking skills transfer and capacity building of universities and other stakeholders? And how will the SAMRC expand its network in this regard? Regarding the Sisonke implementation study, Professor Gray, what were the key lessons for rolling out vaccines for healthcare workers and the nation? Please elaborate on the adverse effects that were found or reported in the study, taking into account the vaccines that are on offer in South Africa. Is there empirical evidence of other more severe adverse effects from vaccinations? Then how long did it take the SAMRC to evaluate the impact of variants of concern on vaccine effectiveness? In hindsight, what could have been done differently, if anything? Last question on that one. What can be said about the safety of vaccines for different categories in this regard? What are the best ways to ensure safety in the field? Then my general comments on this one, Professor Gray. Research indicates that immunization or vaccination is really the most effective preventative measure against serious diseases. There are media reports that indicate that people who have been fully vaccinated could need COVID-19 booster shots within a year to 18 months. The research is ongoing, however. It is very important that we know what to expect. Can the SAMRC briefly elaborate whether the speculations are correct or not regarding the potential need for booster shots? And I've heard that the Sisonke trial and booster shots will start from tomorrow. And what will be the time frame before it reaches the rest of the population? I thank you, Professor Kirk.
Start and start ask and my team to also chip in and answer the question. So for member Christians around the wastewater surveillance. So first of all, when we look at wastewater for surveillance to pick up COVID, we are looking at degraded virus, not viable virus. But this degraded virus, which is excreted in your stools, is not viable. So it's not going to transmit COVID to anyone, but will help us detect in a very early fashion any future outbreaks. So wastewater surveillance is important for that. I'm going to also, we'll go into it a bit more when we ask our other teams to talk about it. But I agree that sewage in our country is in despair. And we never realized how bad the sewage was in our country until we started to do this work. And Professor Angela Mati will just highlight some of the stuff. And one of the first things we need to do at a municipal level is to make sure that we can sort out our sewage systems, because I think they're in disarray, and they can cause a lot of other ill health, like E. coli in our water, and which can cause diarrhea and other things. We'll ask Angela just to talk a little bit later about some of the issues that we face, but we do want to flag wastewater and sewage, because it is a huge problem in our country, and we agree with you. It poses a lot of danger, not only in the Northern Cape, but in all parts of our country, and Angela will talk a little bit more about that. Today, at the moment, infections are very low, and you're correct. These are the people that are coming forward for testing. Obviously, testing always underreports the true amount of cases in the country, but we are reassured by looking at our death data. So we track excess deaths in the country, and excess deaths correlates with the epidemic, and we also correlated with the hospital admissions, and so we can say that the excess deaths together with hospital admissions are showing a decline in the number of COVID infections in our country, cases will always be, the tests that we know will always be an underrepresentation, because not everybody who is symptomatic and not everybody who is sick will go for a COVID test. So they always are underreported, but we can see by other levels like deaths and hospitalizations that the rates are low at the moment. And what can we do to keep them like that? We can keep them like that by, number one, vaccinating. We have to increase our coverage of vaccination in this country. And all these interventions are very important. Without good vaccine coverage, it's very hard for us to control future surges. We also need to continue to wash our hands, wear our masks, make sure there's ventilation, and try and make sure we don't that we respect the space, the hand washing, the mask wearing, and the working in well ventilated areas and moving around in well ventilated places. So that's very important for us. In terms of the new drug, the next phase of managing a pandemic is to get a medication that can help treat COVID. So vaccines will help prevent COVID and will help downgrade COVID infection from severe to less severe. But what we do need as well is interventions for therapeutics. And this antiviral is a very important move forward. It doesn't replace vaccines because vaccines are preventative, but this having an antiviral on board means that when people go to the hospital and are very sick, they can take this antiviral. We will have to rely on the company and maybe lobby the company to work with SAHPRA to get this antiviral registered in the country. But it can never replace vaccines. It's just another tool that we will have in our kit to try and control and manage COVID, particularly for people who are in hospital and who are very sick. Hopefully this antiviral will help this. In terms of monitoring trends abroad, it's very important for us to monitor trends abroad because as we open up our borders and as people move around the countries, we know that in winter, in the Northern Hemisphere, COVID outbreaks happen, and they already are happening in Europe. And we need to monitor what variants are happening in those countries. And we need to see how that impacts, because obviously people are moving across the globe. So what we are doing in that respect is that we are monitoring wastewater at the airports, particularly the international section, to see which of the travelers that are coming into our country have evidence of COVID in their stools, and whether there's any new variants that are present in the stool. So those are very important for us. Important for us also to continue to do genome sequencing of any outbreaks in South Africa. If we look at last year, we started to have a surge in late November, early December, and this was propagated a lot by movement of young people. Young people had been restrained throughout the year, and there was a lot of mixing of people who were in matric, who then obviously brought the COVID infections into the household. So we have to wait. We had a very torrid Delta surge, the Delta surge that infected a lot of people together with the vaccines may have an impact on the severity and the duration and the timing of the next wave. But what we have to do in this stage is, in anticipation of the next wave, is we have to make sure we increase our vaccine coverage. And we'll come back to some of those later when I ask some of the other members and my other committee teams to talk. Member Ndegeni asked about the funding and whether we have enough money for future research and how much is needed. We will need a lot more money for research. We cobbled away a budget, and we were fortunate enough to get more money from Treasury and from the Department of Science and Innovation, and to work with TIER. But if we want to be involved in vaccine development, like the mRNA hub that we are hosting here in South Africa, we are going to have to fund a lot of the innovation. We also need to fund local drug development as well as diagnostic development. So although we're able to leverage our money, South Africa is very good with leveraging our money, and our money leveraging has helped us work with other collaborators. We've had a lot of multilateral collaborators. The first one was with the NIH COVPN that helped us do some of the COVID vaccine trials in South Africa, that helped us establish that the J&J vaccine worked. So that was a collaboration with the NIH COVPN, Operation Warp Speed and BARDA. We've also worked with the Gates Foundation, who've helped co-fund the Sonkey study together with the Elmer Foundation and the Dell Foundation. We work very closely with BRICS we worked with them on the diagnostics, and we'll go further into that, but we have a very good relationship with BRICS. And then with the Africa CDC and the AU, we've worked with diagnostics and supported them in surveillance as well. So strategic partnerships are important. We are indebted to the to China for supporting the diagnostic development and also to supporting access to PPE. We're working with Nomalux and the and Sinovac from China in looking at the coronavirus vaccine in children. So there is a study ongoing in South Africa that looks at the coronavirus vaccine. This is a two-dose vaccine. It's an inactivated vaccine. It's been given to about 30 million children worldwide. And we're busy evaluating that in children from as young as 6 months to as old as 12. And that data is, we've enrolled around 2,000 children in the country, and together with Nomalux, and they will be showing the data to the VMAC as well. Why do parents bring their children to be vaccinated? I think that for the study, a lot of the people that brought their children forward had already been involved in COVID vaccine research and saw the value of COVID vaccine research. And so that's why a lot of the children have come forward to be involved in this research. In terms of the vaccine rollout, as we know that the single dose Pfizer is given to children over 12, that's been going very well. The reason to vaccinate children is to try and keep the academic school year open. 40% of school days were lost, and by vaccinating children, we can prevent severe COVID in children, as well as keeping the school open, and also as well as protecting teachers and households. We know we live in intergenerational households, and so if we can prevent a COVID infection coming into the household through a child, we can be maybe able to prevent COVID in elderly people who are in the program. In terms of consenting, children over 12 can consent to interventions, and but we have seen a lot of collaboration between parents and children, and it's nice to see parents bringing their children through to be vaccinated, but the child will provide consent for that, and we'll ask for some of the other EMC members to talk a little bit more about that. In terms of member Gillion, about the vaccine going down in age. So in order to start to control COVID transmission and COVID infection in the country, we need to increase coverage. And we need to make sure that people over 60, over 50, over 40, over 30, and anyone under 18, between 12 and 18, gets vaccinated. Because the only way we can impact on the next wave is to make sure we increase the coverage of our vaccine. We have to try and understand vaccine hesitancy a little bit more. A lot of people are undecided, and they're not anti-vaxxers, but they're scared of the side effects, and you know they don't know anyone in their community that has had vaccines. And so we need to spend a little bit more time, particularly in rural areas and in other age groups, to try and understand what makes people scared to get the vaccine. And we've seen that a lot of people, once they know, have the knowledge of the vaccine, they're very happy to take it. And so I think we need to spend more time. In the beginning of the vaccine rollout, there was always a problem with supply, and we had to be very careful how we created demand when there was no supply. We didn't want vaccine sites to be mobbed. And so we had to be very careful how we rolled out the vaccine. But now that the supply has been secured, we need to do lots of innovation. And we've been doing some innovation in SARS grant queues, in these pop-out things during the IEC. We've seen that happen. We also are working this new program with Vuma. You can get 100 rand if you get a vaccine this month. So that's also important. And it's just to continue to innovate in terms of addressing people's concerns around the vaccine. In terms of the Sasonke implementation study, this implementation study did establish the effectiveness of the COVID-19 J&J vaccine in healthcare workers against death and hospitalization. And we showed that in the beta wave and in the delta wave, this vaccine has shown protection. Because these healthcare workers got the vaccine very early on, and because data has emerged showing that a second dose of the J&J increases vaccine effectiveness. We are boosting, we're going to give the healthcare workers a booster because we know that it's safe, we know that it's immunogenic, and we know that it increases vaccine efficacy. So we want to vaccinate these healthcare workers ahead of a possible next wave that we might anticipate in the December months. I think Angeli will talk more about the collaboration between the MRC and the wastewater, and the Water Commission. Angie, you'll talk about the Water Research Commission and our collaboration with them. In terms of funding research and innovation, we are evaluating COVID-19 in children. Children who are immunosuppressed and who may have TB or maybe HIV infected or have other illnesses are vulnerable to adverse events. Some children who get COVID get a post-inflammatory syndrome, which is one of another reasons why we try and want to vaccinate children, because we want to prevent any severe outcomes in children who may get COVID. Michelle will talk about the solidarity trial in the Crown, and then Angie will talk about the Water Research Committee and other questions around the wastewater and the issues around the difficulties in sewage research. In terms of the Sasonki, the lessons learned, what are the lessons learned? We've seen, I think we learned about, what are the lessons learned? The lesson learned was how to make sure the electronic vaccine data system worked. And so we were able to test the electronic vaccine data system and develop a electronic record, which gives us access to a vaccine certificate that you can use all over the country. The Sasonki trial, because we were able to track the healthcare workers, we've got very good data on hospitalization, on the impact of comorbidities, the impact of age, the impact of HIV on vaccine effectiveness. And this will help us develop strategies to enhance the durability of vaccines. The important thing of the Sasonki program also is our ability to evaluate whether there is waning efficacy and to time the boost. By giving the healthcare workers the boost now, we'll be able to assess for future people who got the single dose J&J, what is the best time to get the boost, and it'll help us to evaluate how a boosting regimen improves effectiveness. The important thing also around the Sasonki taught us about the impact of the variants of concern on vaccine effectiveness, so that was very important, and also taught us about the side effects of the vaccine. And we were very happy and reassured to see that the vaccine side effects were not different to what has been reported all over the world. And that when we looked at the vascular disorders and the nervous system disorders and the immune system disorders, the amount of side effects by organ class were not different to what we saw at a global level. There are some rare events, that there are some rare side effects that occur. For every 1 million vaccinations you get, you may get four rare side effects with Guillain-Barré syndrome. And also that usually occurs mostly in men. And but if recognized, it's easily to treat. In women, we see between 2 and 4 per a million vaccinations, we may see this rare thrombotic thrombocytopenia event, and if identified, also is easy to treat. And so we've been able to develop capacity to develop the side to treat side effects, and also to make sure that the number of side effects in South Africa is not more than where we see in any other parts of the world. So we don't have any safety signals. And so giving the Sasonki boost will help us understand what the safety side effects are of getting two boosts, and will add the global knowledge on this. We definitely are happy that we have a good handle on the side effects that we see in South Africa, and that they're no different to other parts of the world. What we have also looked at, because sometimes it's very hard to know whether there is the side effect is increased as compared to background side effects. And so we've been looking at data to see, what is the expected number of thrombotic events we should see, and getting vaccinated, this increased the number of side effects. And the only area we saw that there was an increase was in the Guillain-Barré syndrome, which we know about at a global level, and also in the thrombotic thrombocytopenia, which has been well described at a global level. In terms of the COVID infections, breakthrough infections amongst healthcare workers, most of them were mild. So there were around 22,000 breakthrough infections. And all of those, most of them were mild. And we definitely saw an impact and reduction in hospitalization and death post-vaccination. The value of Sasanke is that we will be able to track these healthcare workers over time to see, so of those healthcare workers who decide not to be boosted, we'll be able to compare boosted healthcare workers to non-boosted healthcare workers. And if any other vaccine becomes available to these healthcare workers, we'll be able to evaluate the impact of the new vaccines boosted on as compared to the J&J boost. I'm going to ask Angie to talk a little bit more about the wastewater surveillance, and then to ask Mongezi and Michelle just to add anything about some of the therapeutic stuff that we've been doing. Angie?
Yes, just to concur with Prof. Gray, that the wastewater, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, doesn't survive very long in wastewater at all, much shorter survival periods than poliovirus, for example. So, and we're just picking up fragments, so that's not a major public health concern for us. More importantly is the state of dysfunction of our wastewater treatment plants from a broader public health perspective. We have been truly shocked at what we've seen, how dysfunctional, how insecure the wastewater treatment plants are, to the extent that in some instances we've declined to include certain wastewater treatment plants in our program because we think it is just far too dysfunctional to be useful for our program, and moreover, the concerns for the public health of the affected communities from other ill health conditions is a major concern. So in that regard, we have received some funding through a partnership with colleagues in the United Kingdom and in Nigeria, and we hope to intensify our research on non-sewered communities in the coming months. On the partnership with the Water Research Commission, the Water Research Commission funds the NICD to do the wastewater surveillance for them. And so we do have a partnership with the NICD. We have regular meetings. There are links between our two dashboards, and we're having discussions about joint projects, for example, on variants of concern. We also compare our methods, and we belong to the same wastewater surveillance networks in the country. There's definitely collaboration going on there. And then on capacity development, some of our partners are the University of Fort Hare, University of Venda, Sefako Makhato University. And in that regard, we've been able to provide equipment, consumables training, laboratory training, as well as field training. We are just about, we hope in December now, to start a program of data analysis support, as well as writing training. So we definitely has been the case that where there was no capacity before, the MRC has been able to facilitate capacity in poorly resourced institutions going forward. And there is the possibility of a future collaboration on non-SARS-CoV-2 research, like I mentioned earlier, on chronic diseases, tracking HIV/AIDS in communities, etc. I think I've covered all the questions that were asked to me, but obviously happy to answer any others. Dr. Mongezi Mdluli, who leads the program on wastewater at the MRC, may also have additional comments to make.
Thanks, Angie. I think you covered most of the stuff, or all of them, that were asked. Thank you very much.
Chair, we've just got some discussion about the therapeutics that was asked, that the solidarity and the crown. So we're just going to answer that question.
Thanks. It's Michelle Mulder here. Sorry, I didn't introduce myself earlier. So we've been co-supporting the Solidarity Trial and the Crown Coronation. The Solidarity Trial is being undertaken by, or was undertaken by the Wits Health, Wits Reproductive Health Institute, Wits RHI. They were significant participators in this global trial. Unfortunately, the results indicated that the four drugs that were used had no direct effect on hospitalization, initiation of ventilation, or preventing deaths. So those results came out some time ago. There was a plan for the same sites to be involved in the Solidarity Plus trial, but when they looked at the different drugs that were planned to be used in that, they were not feasible for use in South Africa due to contraindications with existing standard of care, and various other reasons. So the Wits RHI are not participating further in the Solidarity trial, as far as I'm aware. The Crown Coronation study started off as a study looking at hydroxychloroquine, but it was realized quite early on that this was not really going to have an effect. It was for prevention in healthcare workers. So they've amended the protocol, and they are now looking at the MMR vaccine as a potential preventative. And of course, this has been done in the context of new vaccines specifically for COVID coming on board and showing efficacy. So they've had to adapt, and they've expanded this beyond healthcare workers. So as of March this year, there were 11 sites recruiting, just around 1,200 participants in South Africa who are participating in that study. Thank you. So thank you, Chair. So we're happy to ask answer any more questions. But I think we lost you.
Thank you, Dr. Gray. Let me take this opportunity to be a temporal chairperson because we've got a problem of network. I'm sorry about that. Members, any person want to have a second bite? Is anybody, hey, Michelle, Ms. Marcel, I don't see anything. If you have any, you see any hand, can you please help me?
Thank you, Ms. Mangeni. I do have two questions from Ms. Lahihi, if you permit me to ask those questions.
Yes, dear.
I'll go ahead now.
Yes.
The question was, what were the key lessons for roll-out vaccine for healthcare workers and for the nation? And the second one, what are the difficulties in conducting sewage research for virus spread monitoring? That was the two questions.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Doctor. Can you please help us with the answers?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. The key lessons for the rollout, we learned about, first of all, how to scale up. So we learned about vaccine data system and the importance of electronic records, which are critical for national health insurance and a future health system. So I think that was the first important thing. The second thing, it taught us how to scale up. We had never done an adult vaccination program, and the Sasanki period taught us how to go to scale. It taught us about how to manage the whole vaccine process, the registration, what to do and how to move people through the various stations and to be able to do 100 at any one site to do 100 vaccinations an hour. And so this preliminary period taught us how to take the vaccine to scale. And just to remind you that the country now has the capacity to do between 250,000 to 300,000 vaccines a day. So every 2 days, we have about 400,000 vaccines happening. And the vaccine rollout has gone from strength to strength. And when we were doing our vaccine rollout, we had very little vaccine supply, and we could only do 20,000
vaccines a day. So imagine that we've gone from 20,000 vaccines to 200,000 vaccines a day, and that is phenomenal. So that was the lessons to learn how to scale up. It also taught us about safety and how to manage safety. And so we were able to we established a safety desk, and we were able to support once the national rollout transitioned, we were able to support the National Department of Health in how we manage the safety events in our study. And so that was very important. And we were also able to work with the Department of Health in terms of managing other safety events. But because everybody knew Sasonki, whether you got a Pfizer or a J&J, people would contact our safety desk, and we were able to support the National Department of Health in that. Other key lessons is about training. So we were able to train vaccinators how to administer the vaccine. We were also able to establish the cold chain storage. So before we were able, the whole vaccine program needed transportation, needed depots to store the vaccine, and needed a system to move the vaccine through the supply chain management. And this initial process taught us how to manage vaccine deployment and how to manage the cold chain. So lots of lessons that were learned in that. And just to say that the vaccine rollout now is incredibly sophisticated, and the movement of vaccines all over the country is well orchestrated. You put your request in for vaccines on a Wednesday, and that is delivered to your institution. The EBDS is critical for us to manage stock and to manage numbers and to manage side effects and to also evaluate from a population level how the vaccines are doing. So I think there's a lot of things that we learned in terms of the Sasonki rollout. And again, Sasonki will help the national rollout again, because we're now entering into how do we boost. And so we will be able to work with the Department of Health and explain to them and support them in the boosting of other people who were in the national rollout. In terms of difficulties in the wastewater surveillance, so wastewater surveillance is important not only for SARS-CoV-2 surveillance, it's important for surveillance for polio, for measles, and for other infectious diseases. And these will also alert us to, if we start to do surveillance in measles and polio and other infectious diseases, it can alert us to vaccine breakage. In we know already that last year a lot of children didn't get their immunizations because of the parents were scared to go to the health system. So by doing wastewater surveillance for polio, measles, we are able to then alert the authorities that there's a break in vaccination coverage in certain infectious diseases. So I think it's going to be very critical for us. It also tells us about what else is happening in terms of people who are taking antihypertensives, people are on ARVs, and that helps us understand how people are managing their chronic diseases going forward. But I'll ask Angela to also expand on that. So wastewater is also important for drugs. So if we are worried about illicit drug use, by looking at wastewater, we can pick up pockets in communities where there is a use of illicit drugs, and that will help us manage drug abuse in our country. And I don't think you wanted to say anything more about that.
Just to add, the promise of wastewater surveillance to help produce a new or amend or add to the public health model that we have, because like Professor Gray says, there's so much information. It's really a treasure trove of information in wastewater that we haven't really capitalized on up to now. In terms of the challenges, it is really just the complexity of it, the logistics of getting information, all the small minor things that can go wrong in getting the samples to the laboratories, getting the consumables that we need. But we have a really passionate, energetic team that is determined to make a difference, to do their bit to help prevent disease and to save lives. So all the challenges over the past year and a half, we've been able to manage all of them. Funding and resources is always a challenge. We think we have brilliant ideas in terms of extending the platform that the SAMRC has created. And additional funding would always be very well received. Thanks.
Sorry, I forgot what I'm sharing now. Thank you, Dr. Crane, about the information. Masan, anybody or any member have a question?
No, I think we've come to the end of our question and answer session. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Crane, about the presentation and the information. We appreciated that, but I can release you so that we can continue with our meeting. Thank you very much, Dr. Craig and your team.
Thank you very much. And we're very happy to have presented to you, and good luck on your future deliberations and happy to come back again. Thank you very much.
You will. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Ms. Nungeni, I will share the draft first-term program for members to peruse, and then we can adopt that program.
Okay. Is it a first-term program or?
Yes, Ms. Nungeni, it's a first-term program.
Oh, okay. Members, anybody can adopt? Hello?
Chairperson, are you able to see the screen? Are you able to see the program?
Yes.
Do you want me to read through the program, or is it are members able to just look from the program and then we can decide, then we can move on?
No, we must move on because everybody have the program.
Members, I'll wait on you, Chairperson.
Members, can you please help me? Anybody can move for the adoption of the program?
Christians, move for the adoption.
Oh, thank you, Member Christian. The second one? Hello?
Let me second, Chairperson.
Oh, thank you, Honorable Baha. Michelle, where we are now?
Chairperson, the adoption of the program is the final agenda item. If you are ready, we can close the meeting.
Oh, thank you very much. Members, we come to the end of our meeting now. Thank you very much for your availability. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot. The meeting has been adjourned.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, members.
All right.
Recording stopped.